All right, this is coming up. I also have no financial relationships. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the policy implications. Can everyone hear me? So we've heard a lot of research today about what is happening with sexual minority youth. And I'm going to talk about the policies around sexual education that helps to further and stigmatize sexual minority youth. I work for an organization called SECUS, the Sexuality Information Education Council of the United States. I head up our state policy unit. I'm going to talk about abstinence-only until marriage programs. I'm going to talk about where these programs have come from and the specific impact on LGBTQ youth. I'm going to talk about why they don't work and on a positive note, that we are actually moving away from them. Everything I'm talking about is in a special report that SECUS has released. I will have copies of the executive summary. I really hate these things. Can I just talk? No, you can't hear me. Can you hear me? No, you can't hear me. I'm sorry. I really hate these things. Okay. All right. I'm going to start off with... I'm sorry. It's just not working for me. Can you hear me? All right. I'm going to start off with a definition of comprehensive sexuality education. First of all, it emphasizes abstinence, but it also includes information on contraception, including condoms. Educators can answer all questions. It's medically accurate and evidence-based. This is not going to work. Okay. And includes information on decision-making, communication, and most importantly, it's evidence-based and medically accurate. The best comprehensive sexuality education programs include information on sexual orientation, on abortion, and there's two really important things to take away from this. Parents overwhelmingly support comprehensive sexuality education, and there is not one federal dime dedicated to this. Instead, we put our money into abstinence-only until marriage programs. I'm going to go through these three funding streams pretty quickly. As an advocate and as an advocacy organization, it's important for me to educate people on these funding streams. But the one thing that I want you to take away from this is that these programs are not new. Our opponents try to say that these programs haven't been around. Oh, gosh. Here we go. All right, our opponents try to say that these programs are new and they haven't had time to be evaluated and we need to put more energy and money into them. But the reality is they've been around since 1982. Reagan brought this to us, and they were originally sold as chastity education and a counter to the Title X family planning program. The idea was to put money into abstinence programming. $13 million annually, that allocation has not changed since that time. Fast forward to 1996. Welfare reform is coming about. Kind of seems like a funny place to put in abstinence programming. And Newt Gingrich is in charge of Congress. And the conservatives are thinking about how to keep people off of welfare. And so they came up with this concept of abstinence education. It's a $50 million block grant awarded to the states, and it's divided up based on how many young people you have living in poverty. And so this is the first time we got an 8-point definition of abstinence education. And I'm going to show this to you. This is really important for the way that these programs have an impact on LGBT youth. As you can see, it says that you have to teach about abstinence, but it also says that abstinence from sexual activity, sexual activity outside of marriage is the expected standard for all school-aged children, that a mutually faithful monogamous relationship within the context of marriage is the expected standard of sexual activity. It gets better. That sexual activity outside the context of marriage is likely to have harmful psychological and physical effects. Now, my boss likes to say that if this were true, we'd be a nation of lunatics, because, of course, 95% of Americans have sex before marriage. That bearing children out of wedlock is likely to have harmful consequences for the child, the children's parents, and society. Now, at first, with Title V, some states used to just do one or two of these, such as if you drink or do drugs, you're more vulnerable to sexual advances. A lot of states used to do that, such as Vermont, Massachusetts. You can't do that anymore. In 2000, President Bush came along, and he loves abstinence programming. Loves it, okay? Comprehensive sexuality education has advocates but from both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The same is true of abstinence only until marriage programming. So it has no party bounds. But President Bush loves abstinence only until marriage. And he created community-based abstinence education. It's the largest source of abstinence funding, and the funding goes straight from the federal government to the organization. So there's no state intermediary. It started off at $20 million a year. It's now awarded at $113 million. That's a 450% increase in about a six-year span. So that's huge. And with CBAE, they changed the definition of abstinence education. You used to be able to meet just one point. Now you have to meaningfully represent all 8 points. So if you take the money, you cannot stray from those 8 points. You have to meaningfully represent all of them. And it's really created an industry. So now I want to go into what this industry looks like and how it impacts LGBT youth. And that's the focus of our special report. So abstinence only until marriage programming, it's funded each year at $176 million. Over the last 25 years, that's $1.5 billion. And I'll get to a couple slides later on the fact that it doesn't work. It hasn't been proven to work. It doesn't work. But it has created an industry of curricula, of gadgets, of water bottles. It really is, seriously, water bottles. and stickers. You know, don't pet your date, pet your dog. You know, these are the lines. And none of it's proven to work. And it's sold as teen pregnancy prevention and STD prevention, but it's really a marriage promotion industry. It goes back to those 8 points that I showed you earlier. And I'm really gonna focus on the curricula. The report goes in depth about DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, healthy marriage funds, which are another source of federal funding that go to organizations. A lot of the same organizations that get abstinence only until marriage funds also get healthy marriage funds. But I really want to focus on the curricula, because there's a few abstinence only until marriage curricula which exist in most states and have a few themes that really impact LGBT youth. And a lot of people have already talked about these themes today. They really overlap a lot. The first one is really marriage as a mandate. The focus on marriage is really to the exclusion of anything else. No matter what these curricula are talking about, they're really talking about marriage. Whether they're talking about marriage or teen pregnancy, if they do mention that, they're talking about the benefits of marriage. Sex outside of marriage is labeled as morally wrong or sinful or dangerous, which just really presents no other option for GLBT students. And I'm going to show you a lot of quotes from the curricula. You can read that on our Community Action website. The strong attraction between men and women is part of what makes marriage so wonderful. Heritage Keepers is used all across the country, and no matter where you are in the curriculum, you'll see quotes like this. CECUS, my organization, we read all of these curricula to see what they're actually teaching our youth. Something that you see in every single one of these curricula is that it assumes heterosexuality. All the examples are presented as male-female dichotomies. These curricula really enjoy presenting a lot of examples between young women and young men, a lot of games that involve young men and young women. Weight training, which is developed by a woman in Colorado, has this really elaborate example of setting up a wedding. And, you know, you're supposed to have a mock wedding with a bride and a groom, and the teacher is supposed to reserve the gym and get music. And so, again, it's going back to that theme of marriage, but also it's, although you're only allowed, you know, it also goes back to the assuming heterosexuality. So another theme is disparaging non-traditional families. This goes back, again, to the 8-point definition. This is codified in federal code, and it's promoting one single family structure as the ideal. Sex respect and abstinence only until marriage curriculum. It's a little less popular, but it's very regional, used in very specific parts of the country. It says, having two parents was not a social invention. In the nature of conception, cells from both a man and a woman are involved. It follows that in meeting the human needs of children, it is best when a father and a mother are involved too. So not only is this disparaging single-family households and divorced family household, but LGBT individuals who may want to know how to prepare for their own families that they might lead one day. It just doesn't do anything to prepare LGBT individuals. So the strategy that most abstinence-only until marriage programs take is just to ignore gay and lesbian students completely. It sends a very powerful message that they are not worthy of inclusion, that they are unequal to their peers, and doesn't give them any information to prepare them to make healthy decisions. Weight training is one of the more popular programs, insists that it prepares young people, young gay and lesbian students, saying they need to be abstinent, learn about healthy relationships, and how to love well. Weight training completely subsists on abstinence only until marriage funding and healthy marriage funding. Yet, in their curriculum, the words gay or lesbian never come up. They're completely ignored. So I'm not so sure that it's actually good for gay or lesbian students. Probably the most startling thing about these curricula is that they spread inaccurate information about homosexuality. Bias, intolerance, and assumptions are all assumed as fact in these curricula. The curricula as a whole have a lot of misinformation, but when it comes to homosexuality, they are especially bad. And here's one quote. Homosexual activity involves an especially high risk for HIV transmission. We know that actual heterosexual activity is the highest risk for HIV transmission. And I just want to show these. Virginity pledges. So if you don't know, and if you didn't have the pleasure of signing one, a virginity pledge is a card that you sign to pledge to wait till marriage to have sex. So obviously, you're leaving out an entire population of students if you're asking them to sign away their virginity till marriage when LGBT students can't get married in most states. There's a problem with virginity pledges because the science says, and we know, that 88% of pledgers eventually have sex before marriage. There's a little fear and shame in this, too. If you read the back of it, it says it can produce negative returns if you have sex before marriage. You might get some unwanted memories and a broken heart, and all assets can be potentially lost, such as death. But if you wait, you can yield greater respect for yourself and for your future husband or wife. So going back to that male-female dichotomy, you know, they don't work, and obviously expiration date, wedding day, going back to that marriage mandate. Okay. So in sum, these programs fail to provide any kind of information for LGBT youth to make healthy decisions about their future or their sexual health. They give the message that discrimination against LGBT youth is acceptable. And we know that in environments where comprehensive sexuality education is taught and where an open conversation is allowed, there is less discrimination against gay and lesbian students. GLSEN does a school survey. It's a self-select. But they know that where abstinence-only until programs exist, there's higher rates of school harassment and violence. I said I'd mention the research and evaluation. There's a lot of research out there showing that these programs just don't work. I have a fact sheet out here if you'd like more information on that. We know that real sex ed works. Where actually comprehensive sexuality education is actually better at making students become abstinent. And I just wanted to leave on a positive note, 25 states have actually withdrawn from the Title V abstinence only until marriage program due to the strong evidence against the programs. And a couple states have actually said this is especially bad for our vulnerable students, such as gay and lesbian students. We've seen that argument in a couple states. We had our first congressional hearing on abstinence only until marriage programs in April. And we're seeing sex ed talked about in ways that we've never seen it before. It's a part of the Democratic Party platform, comprehensive sexuality education. It's also part of the Republican Party platform. They want to strip all family planning funding and instead replace it with abstinence only until marriage funding. I'm not telling you who to vote for. just giving you the information. So we're seeing it talked about in ways that we've never have before. We're in a really good position. So we're seeing a paradigm shift towards a more comprehensive approach, which will have a good impact, an important impact on populations already made vulnerable to discrimination and other impact. So that's all I got. And there's our website.
And on that informative note, we are ready to take questions from any of you who may have questions for any of the people who have made a presentation. Jim, you have a question?
Yes, for Katrina, two-part. Are your findings written up? And secondly, did you find racial ethnic disparities in your research?
Why don't you just stand? You don't have to go to the mic.
I don't have to go to the mic?
I don't think so.
Okay. My voice is pretty loud. The finding, right, they are written up, it's under review right now. And one thing I did forget to mention is we have some booklets for the Healthy Young Men study if people are interested, that some of that is kind of summarized in here as well. As far as ethnic disparities, I didn't really look for that in the qualitative data because it was a small sample and didn't really see that. It looks like across the board, those findings were holding up, that the information just wasn't there. Is that
okay? Please do, yes.
There are certain parts in the absent and fully until marriage curriculum where they discuss what if you don't want to get married, and then there's really no honest conversation on that. But really, the conversation around marriage is marriage and also children. So there's really no honest conversation on preparing yourself for not having children. There's no honest conversation on condoms. You're actually explicitly not allowed to talk about condoms within the abstinence only until marriage. So is that your question?
Yeah, so basically they just assume that after you get married,
you're gonna have babies and you'll be safe. Well, the curricula, they assume that once you're in a married situation, you'll be safe and happy and all is right with the world. So they sell marriage as the end all be all. So you won't need, condoms or, any kind of relationship advice or anything like that, because marriage is the cure-all. Yeah. It's not delightful.
Do we have any more questions? Yes, back in the back, please.
One of the things that seemed to cut across the whole panel is the idea that sexual minorities aren't welcomed society. Is there something that you would encourage healthcare providers to do to make sexual minorities more welcome, feel more welcome?
Is that an open question to anybody on the panel? Please feel free if you would like to. Did you hear the question? Did you get the question? Would you care to say something?
Yeah, I can. Kay. There is a site called GLAMA, Gay Lesbian Medical Association, I believe. If you go to their website, there are a number of tips available for making healthcare provider offices more welcoming to gay, lesbian, transgender, and questioning youth.
You mentioned healthcare specifically, but American Psychological Association has a whole curriculum on how to be an ally so that all kids are safe in schools, and that's got excellent materials and has some technical assistance pieces to it as well.
And GLSEN also has some materials on how to make your schools a more safe place. It has a principal guide. GLSEN is the Gay, Lesbian, School Educators Network. They have a principal's guide and a school's guide.
I thought that was a very good question and gave some very, we have some very good responses for that. You'll see we have a number of resources available in the room, addressing the very thing that you've just brought up. Another question, did I see someone here? Yes, sir, please.
I had a question for the second speaker, Katrina. I thought it was very interesting, the use of pornography for sexual education. And was there any mention of or any effect that you heard from your respondents about the use of condoms? And gay porn tends to more often have gay condoms depicted. And whether that was any risk reduction benefit, prevention benefit?
It's a good question. And none of them spoke to that about seeing any kind of protective behaviors in pornography. Several of them actually kind of took the opposite point of view, saying that they really learned nothing good from porn, that they would learn some kind of fetishing behaviors or some unhealthy practices, but did not volunteer information about learning anything protective from porn.
We have a question up front right here.
This is for Kathleen. Do you know if there is any, like, maybe evaluation data or something about the comprehensive sex education and how students really are receiving this information in the classroom? Because still there is, I feel like there is still this hostile kind of attitude towards GLBT youth in schools. And so is there any information on how these classroom discussions, when they're talking about GLBT relationships and sexuality, what kind of things are coming from the students? What kind of feelings are coming from the schools?
So I feel like you're asking two questions. There is good evaluation data on comprehensive sexuality education.
Right.
I can point to that. Is there evaluation data on classroom conversations around GLBT relationships and how that plays out? Is that what you're asking?
Really? Well, so the comprehensive sex education and how they discuss GLBT sexuality, how is that being received by students in kind of the classroom setting? I don't know if that would even be evaluated or anything like that, but I just wonder, how students are receiving this information.
So the best survey data that we have of comprehensive sexuality education doesn't necessarily include the broadest comprehensive sexuality education programs that we would imagine. In the ideal world, everyone would have this kind of conversations, but I would point to Dr. Kirby's study, Emerging Answers, that came out at the end of 2007, and that doesn't necessarily look at those programs. I would again point to GLSEN's school survey, they specifically asked students, are you having those kind of conversations? What is your school environment like? Are you able to talk to teachers? What goes on in your classroom? Go to the GLSEN School Climate Survey. Just came out earlier this month.
You have a question here?
Mm-hmm. So, in California right now, the big Proposition 8 is, very on the forefront of everything right now. How do we, counter that fight against it being a morality issue? A lot of the propaganda right now on Proposition 8 is really like punching at morality issues and issues of family and things like that. So in what ways can we, as public health providers and things like that, how can we, if it's an issue of morality, how do you change the minds of people who believe it's a moral issue?
Does anybody want to, on either side, respond to that profound question? Yeah, you have a comment?
And this is really just from a more of a harm reduction standpoint, and it's not about GLBT youth, it's about the way that the needle exchange bill is introduced in Texas every year, and it's introduced by a Republican state senator who's very religious. fetal exchange because it is a moral issue than to harm clients or to harm patients. So, and by withholding necessary medical information or resources from patients or harming them, and that's immoral and against his religious viewpoint. So I guess countering it with a moral argument that, you know, we should not harm our clients or our patients by withholding information.
They seem to take two stances, the don't mess with our constitution argument and the don't mess with the fundamental right argument. So I'm not from California, but as an advocate, I would say I don't really like the idea of people coming in from another state and 77% funded by people from Utah funding a campaign. So, I mean, there's a lot of arguments to make against it. I don't know what the clear public health argument is. I like the fundamental right argument.
Yes, we have a question in the back. On this side, and we'll go to the left. On this side, then on the left. I can see you. Thank you so much. Please. You had a question, sir, please.
Yes, I apologize for asking two questions.
Oh, not at all. Don't, please.
Very interesting. So my question is for you on the answers. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, and I was surprised, maybe naively surprised, but to see that such a high proportion of Latinas in your sample. And my question has to do with the research that looks at the symbols that Latinos put on words such as condoms or sexuality, and how the symbols and the meanings attached to sexual ideas in the Hispanic culture differ from Caucasian culture, and if the education adjusts for those differences.
Boy, that's a really hard question for me to answer. In our sample, it's predominantly Latino, but they predominantly speak English. They are mostly born in this country. So it's hard for me to say exactly. We haven't done that kind of work. Unless you do have anything to add to that. Yeah, we really haven't done that kind of work, so it's not a question I can answer.
I just wonder if you had a lot of answers that you couldn't really explain, like condom use between two women.
Right.
And I wonder if that was in part related to the misinterpretation of the language that you were using in your surveys. I don't know if your surveys were translated into Spanish or...
Our surveys were translated into Spanish, but we had very few students who wanted a Spanish survey. I think it was close to 10,000. It was about 10,000 surveys, even in middle school and high school. We had probably more middle school students that wanted Spanish surveys, but we had very, very few. And so we don't find any differences by language of the survey or anything like that. So I don't know if that helps, but...
We have about 2 minutes left. Anybody else have a question? Yes, right here, please.
We did not. We had a very basic set of questions. We had probably 15, less than 20 questions, and so we had to really be careful and specific about which questions we asked. We weren't able to ask that. The condom use questions were, you know, less than perfect. So we don't have, and we don't know how many partners they had oral sex with, and there's a lot of things that we couldn't get to in a self-administered format within 30 minutes. You know, the only thing I can think of is that the prevention messages just are not tailored for them. It's part of it. And there's a whole lot of other stuff going on, all the other stuff that's associated with drug use, substance use, things like that. So I also think it's a group that's really, in their own way, very savvy, and sometimes they... working with different samples, like for example, homeless girls who are bisexual. They really are kind of feeling their own power and choosing actively to say, okay, I know this is risky, but I'm going to do it. It's my choice. It's my life. I get to do this. So I think there might be some of that going on as well. It's hard to say. I do think the prevention messages are really are appropriate for that group.
Question? Well, listen, I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon. If you want to chat with the presenters, you may. Let me just put a plug in for the APHA next year, which is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. If you think you're going, if you have an interest in this kind of research or related research, you're doing something in your own offices, in your own venues, I am going to invite you to think about submitting your abstract to the School Health Education and Services section of the APHA for a presentation of your work a year from now. Thank you so much, and thank you to the members of the panel.